the shedding of all of one's past and history and the old country, just leaving all of that behind, coming to America, becoming the ultimate American. I mean, Superman is an alien. He's an immigrant. But he transforms himself into the ultimate symbol of the American way of life, like truth, justice, and the American way of life, with the flag behind him and, you know, and his red and blue and gold colors. And that was, I think it was a powerful expression of both of a wish that immigrants felt and also of the reality, too, that this is the way that you went about doing it and making good in this country.
Superman's Kryptonian origins also took a while to manifest themselves in the comic books. Although the newspaper strip renditions of his adventures, also written by Siegel, laid out the chronicles of his doomed home planet in detail early on, including the names and identities of his parents, eventually burnished into Jor-El and Lara, the traumatic events of Superman's arrival on this planet were not embellished until 1948. And it wasn't until a year later that Superman himself learned of his cosmic origins by flying back in time to trace down fragments of an errant meteor. Of course, the fragments would become known as kryptonite, but not before Superman, in phantom form, shadows his own father and learns the truth of his own beginnings. How could he have known his own story otherwise? Sympathetically, the splash pages of both Krypton stories have Superman holding his head in his hands, bereft on discovering himself the last remnant of an entire culture, survivor guilt, in comic book form. Interestingly, both stories were written not by Siegel, who was booted off the Superman firm by then, but by Bill Finger, Batman's co-creator. Still, the Krypton stories opened an important door into Superman's psyche. By going back into the man of tomorrow's past, scriptwriters found tremendously fertile scenarios in his future for the next 7 decades. In 1938, however, Superman was having a complicated enough time juggling his day job as Clark Kent with his mission of fighting evil as Superman. In popular culture of the 1930s, newspaper reporters were often portrayed as enterprising crusaders. There were numerous radio shows, movies, and plays devoted to their exploits, and besides, having Clark Kent work for a great metropolitan newspaper was convenient for initiating plot lines. Originally, he worked for the Daily Star, although nostalgia or sloppiness put him on the Cleveland Evening News in Action Comics number 2. By 1940, Kent was hanging up his shingle at the Daily Planet, working for editor Perry White. His real complication lay with the brunette at the desk across the newsroom, reporter, and as Siegel called her, sob sister Lois Lane. The triangle of Clark Kent, Lois Lane, and Superman has become one of the most intriguing and dramatically fertile dysfunctional relationships in pop culture. The bespectacled Clark Kent chases after Lois Lane, who is only put off by the awkwardness of his ardor. In the meantime, Lois pines after Superman, who is equally put off by the excesses of her devotion to him. And therein lies the irony. Because Clark Kent and Superman are the same person, the situation becomes a ménage à trois that actually involves only two people. Superman constantly allows himself to be rejected in the form of a false identity he alone has chosen to affect. Whatever level of masochism that Superman submitted to in this arrangement, at least he seemed to be in on the joke by Action Comics number 9. As Clark Kent, he tentatively asks Lois out on a date, to which she responds, "Clark Kent, I despise you." When he summons up the courage to ask if there's anyone else in her life, Lois retorts, "He's grand, he's glorious, he's terrific, he's everything you're not. Brave, bold, handsome, superb." And of course, he's Superman. Kent walks dejectedly to his office, only to close the door and laugh himself silly at the irony. The very irony of that triangle is the wellspring that has fed thousands of narrative tributaries over the decades. It took nearly 10 years before Lois even suspected that Clark himself might be Superman, a suspicion that sparked another wealth of stories. In the first decade or so of his existence, Superman lived a uniquely peripatetic existence in modern media. Neither Popeye, nor The Shadow, nor Mickey Mouse had so many venues to promote their escapades. Superman appeared in comic books, comic strips, radio, even cartoon shorts by 1941. In the devil-may-care days of his early existence, there were often maddening zigzags in continuity for those who cared about such things. Kryptonite makes an embryonic appearance on radio in 1943, then waits until 1949 to reveal itself as a major plot factor in the comic books. That same year, Superman's editors gave him a super room of his own, a fortress of solitude in the Arctic North for contemplation and reflection, which only he could access by virtue of his superhuman strength. This complete lift from Doc Savage's mythos is made slightly less egregious by the fact that pulp stories had pretty much ground to a halt by 1949. But for all the eventual complications rolled up into his mythology, Superman's initial appearance was as simple and as bold as a thunderbolt. As artist Jim Steranko says, "The only mystery is, what the hell took you so long to get here?" Sullivan reportedly asked an associate editor, an inspiring cartoonist named Sheldon Mayer, if there was anything else in the files that might work. Mayer remembered the Superman strip sent to Gaines. Mayer was barely out of his teens himself, and the gee whiz excitement of the Siegel and Schuster strip appealed to him. The strip appealed to Sullivan as well. It was just what the pop culture doctor ordered. Siegel and Schuster had already worked for Detective Comics at this point. They placed a bumptious soldier of fortune named Slam Bradley in the first issue of Detective Comics. The letter Sullivan sent to Cleveland was both pressing and professional. "I have on hand now several features that you sent to Mr. Leibowitz. The one feature I liked best, and the one that seems to fit into the proposed schedule, is that Superman." Sullivan sent back the strips to Siegel and Schuster, giving them 3 weeks to reorganize the strips into 13 pages of comic book story as the lead feature in Action Comics number 1. Siegel and Schuster were not about to stand on ceremony. If this was not quite the daily newspaper splash they had intended for their super creation, it would do. They hastily repurposed the submitted strips, cutting panels, elongating others, writing and drawing new transitions, even extending a brief origin and designing a unique logo. At the end of 3 weeks, Siegel mailed their retrofitted brainchild back to New York. In return, they were given their usual page rate of $10, a total of $130. They also had to sign a release that gave Detective Comics Incorporated the rights to Superman. The boys demurred, but Jack Leibowitz had no desire to enter into legal wrangling. Take it or leave it. The deal that Siegel and Schuster accepted in order to get Superman into print has evolved into one of the more infamous arrangements in American commerce. Some commentators have called it the greatest ripoff since Peter Stuyvesant convinced the Indians to sell Manhattan Island for $24. Others, usually more seasoned veterans, shrug and say, "That's the way it was. Once they bought it, they owned it." The truth is somewhere in between. Indeed, with most of popular culture in the 1930s, the producers owned the product, and anything submitted and paid for was a work for hire. In Hollywood, other than the studios, no entity got a piece of anything. Not directors, not actors, especially not scriptwriters. At exactly the same time that Siegel and Schuster were being offered the chance to have Superman published, Betty Davis was suing Warner Brothers to get out of her studio contract, which declared that she had to act in whatever roles the studio chose for her. She balked, took the Warners to court, lost, and was forced to return to the backlot for them just to make a living, having been wiped out from legal fees. But the long trail of tears and disappointment suborned by Siegel and Schuster seemed very far on the horizon. Like some Depression-era Hollywood fantasy, their dream was going to become a reality. Cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer captures the feeling of the time. "The American story is that we always believe, we always dream. Someday we'll come around the corner. Something might work out." There was a spirit as a kid living in the 1930s, there was a spirit of optimism. We may be losers, we may be in bad shape, but we are going to end up victorious. I knew for certain that I would end up being a famous cartoonist, by golly. I was going to get what I wanted. And other kids felt they were going to get what they wanted. In spring 1938, after struggling with their dream for half a decade, it seemed as if two kids from Cleveland were going to get what they wanted, too. Chapter 2. 64 pages of thrill-packed action. The explosion of an industry. A piece of the action. The publishing phenomenon. Although the debut of Superman was a bombshell to every 11-year-old who bought Action Comics number 1, it took a while for the full implications of a superhero to hit the nascent comic book industry. When they did, they would be an unprecedented event in the history of publishing. Comic books in general were entering the marketplace, newsstands and candy stores, with greater success. Several publishing houses, mostly in New York City, many barely scraping by, were transitioning from pulp novels into comics, diversifying their portfolios, as it were. There were even a few work-for-hire cartoon studios popping up, never mind trying to create an entire pantheon of heroes, costumed or otherwise, from scratch. A publisher could simply order up some characters and pages from a studio. One of the first and most seminal was the Eisner and Iger Studio. In 1939, 21-year-old artist and writer Will Eisner was just out of DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx and schlepping his portfolio around town. Realizing that publishers were going to need more and more original material, he precociously made a deal with Sam Jerry Iger, an editor nearly twice his age, to set up a studio and gradually create a bullpen of artists and writers, just in case someone should knock on the door someday. At the same time, a new wave of action characters who had originated on the radio was becoming popular. They included the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet. The Green Hornet was another wealthy young man about town who fought crime when the sun went down, this time with a mask, a gas gun, and an Asian sidekick who conveniently happened to be his chauffeur. Two early comic book heroes borrowed heavily from the Hornet, the Crimson Avenger and his assistant Wang, who debuted in Detective Comics number 20, 4 months after Superman, and the uninspired Sandman, who also had a gas gun to go with his baggy green suit and clashing purple cape. He started putting criminals, and some readers, to sleep in the summer of 1939. When it came to rip-offs, however, nothing beat the day toward the end of 1938 when there was, in fact, an urgent knock at the door of the Eisner and Iger studio. In walked Victor Fox. Fox had his own publishing house in the same building as Detective Comics and was ostensibly privy to the sales figures on Superman. Fox, reportedly, ordered up a superhero as close to Superman as possible. And in the early spring of 1939, the daring superhuman exploits of the Wonder Man were touted on the cover of Wonder Comics. If there were ever a one-hit wonder, it was Wonder Man. Before a second issue could be completed, Fox was hit by an injunction from Detective Comics, and the character was never heard from again. Slight shame, if only because Eisner's work on the book was more fluid and more dramatic than Schuster's work for the competition. More important, however, was the implication that superheroes were big business, and Detective Comics meant business too. It was the first, but by no means the last, litigation to protect the valuable interests of a successful costumed superhero. Within the course of 18 months, from the middle of 1938 to the end of 1940, 24 publishing houses entered the comic book market, putting out a combined 150 different monthly titles. Here are some of the major players. After the failure with Wonder Man, Victor Fox remained undaunted, solidifying his own Fox Features firm by unleashing a variety of slightly cheesy new super characters by the end of 1939, including the Flame and the Blue Beetle. Artist and comic book historian Jim Steranko defines the Fox style. Fox Publications was the poverty row of comic books, and their superheroes were completely derivative. Their most important hero was the Blue Beetle. I remember one day I talked to Charlie Nicholas, the creator of the Blue Beetle, and I asked him what was it that inspired him to create this rather unusual character named after a bug. And he explained, everything about the fox mentality to me in two words. Green Hornet. Centaur Comics, featuring minor entities such as the Arrow and Phantom of the Fair, who protected the World's Fair and morphed into Phantoman, had begun as early as 1938, but would be out of business 4 years later. The Fiction House imprint would transition from pulp publishing to comic books in 1938 as well, and subcontracted the Eisner and Iger studio to create characters such as Sheena, Queen of the Jungle. The year 1939 would bring other, new, important companies online. The first of the most influential companies was Quality Comics, whose chief, Everett Busy Arnold, brought in Will Eisner to create popular characters such as Doll Man, Plastic Man, and the Blackhawks. The other important company from 1939 was the firm variously known as Marvel Comics and Timely Comics, which was founded by Martin Goodman, another former pulp publisher, although with slightly darker tastes. Marvel Timely blurred the line between pulps and comics with characters such as the Human Torch and the Submariner, who often slugged their way through their books without much concern for ethics or clean living. Prize Publications featured well-drawn characters such as the Black Owl and the Green Llama, who began in the pulps, and who was the first of many superheroes mentored in some obscure Asian monastery. Lev Gleason Publications, also 1939, brought in imaginative artists to create shriekingly dramatic comic characters such as Silverstreak, Daredevil, not the 1960s version, and the first supervillain, the Claw. MLJ Comics, founded by former magazine publishers Morris Coyne, Louis Silbercleet, and John Goldwater, appeared just as the 1930s ended. MLJ trotted out some good titles featuring the Shield and the Black Hood, before ultimately giving their line over to Archie Andrews, the eternal post-pubescent hero of his eponymous comics in 1947. Hillman, which built its firm in the magazine business, cornered the market on Flying Aces, a successful staple of the pulp era, only now with superhero costumes. Heroes included Airboy, Skywolf, and the Monstrous Heap. Street and Smith transformed their pulp heroes into full-color illustrations with somewhat uninspired renderings of the Shadow and Doc Savage, who was given a ridiculous superhero costume with a magic hood. Most important, a firm called Fawcett Publications transitioned from magazines and books for kids into full-fledged comics with the introduction of Whiz Comics, the venue for Captain Marvel. Originally based in Minnesota, Fawcett was unique for having a non-Manhattan base and a distribution network centered in the Midwest. They produced comic books that, according to Arthur Gerard Jones, even a Lutheran could love. Dell Publications deserves a special Cartoon Medal of Honor. They cornered the market on funny animal comics by sewing up licensing from Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, Bugs Bunny, and so forth, and Woody Woodpecker. They were far and away the most successful comic book publishers of the 1940s and 50s. As most of these 64-page monthly comic books were showcases for a variety of characters, hundreds of spanking new superheroes exploded on the American scene within 2.5 years of Superman's debut. The only comparable explosion in popular culture might be the creation of the American Popular Songbook after World War I, the hundreds of Broadway and Tin Pan Alley tunes which entered our national consciousness and remain lodged there to this day, but that took more than 2 decades to accomplish. Of course, this phenomenon wasn't due to Superman alone, but more likely to the 1-2 punch cooked up over at DC Comics in spring 1939. DC Comics editor Vin Sullivan, who advocated for the inclusion of the Superman character in Action Comics a year earlier, had seen the appeal of costume superheroes and realized that the publishing company needed to boost its stable beyond the Man of Tomorrow. He tapped Bob Kane, a young cartoonist who had been supplying yet another Soldier of Fortune strip to Detective Comics. Kane, whose real name was Khan, had attended the same Bronx high school as Will Eisner, had been trained in art school, and was trying to make it as a freelancer. He took on the assignment to create a new superhero and brought in a casual friend named Bill Finger for advice, Finger, 2 years older, had also gone to DeWitt Clinton High School and was an avid pulp fiction reader. Kane was inspired by various flying characters in the comics, birds and bats, and Finger helped him refine the idea into a nocturnal emissary against crime with the terrifying effect of a bat. The character was, in fact, a Batman. Bob Kane created him with the only kind of innocence you can have as a teenage boy, said artist Neil Adams, to create something that seems different and borrow it from everything that you can borrow it from. Sullivan showcased the Batman as the cover character and lead feature in Detective Comics No. 27, published in May of 1939, and sales took off. Within a year, the Batman would gain his own book devoted solely to his adventures, while continuing as the lead feature in Detective Comics, as well as another featured strip in the world's finest anthology. Bob Kane quickly took his place among seminal comic book creators, branding each new adventure with his idiosyncratic signature. The reality was more complex. Kane was possessed of an important superpower, chutzpah. He had an intrinsic dislike for sharing the stage, while his collaborator Bill Finger was introspective and self-effacing. Finger seemingly didn't mind that his younger partner took credit for the plots and mythology that he himself added to the Batman. Kane also managed to outdo even Siegel and Shuster in one critical respect. His father worked for the New York Daily News and had an insider's knowledge of the legal ramifications of creating characters for a powerful syndicate. Armed with a lawyer's advice, Kane apparently negotiated a contract with Detective Comics that kept him deeply entwined in the creative and financial enterprise of Batman for the next 4 decades. In the meantime, on his own merits, and seemingly without legal advice, Batman emerged as the other pillar of the DC Comics community. His self-developed skill set and crepuscular persona were the perfect complement to Superman's impervious confidence and brightly colored optimism. They represented the same worlds that the Shadow and Doc Savage had respectively in the pulps, darkness and light, mystery and action. As Neil Adams put it, within a year, you had Superman, who was so powerful that he could move planets, and then you had Batman, who had no powers at all. He was the opposite. All the other superheroes would fit in between these two characters. Superman and Batman were tag-team gods, perched at the very top of the comic book Olympus. Between them, they inspired hundreds of characters, characters who would in turn inspire the imaginations of millions of Americans, young and old. Batman. In a universe of spectacularly and powerfully endowed super beings, Batman's most endearing trait was, and is, his vulnerability. As one of the Cape Crusaders' greatest interpreters in the 1970s, artist Neil Adams puts it,
Batman is Sherlock Holmes and one of the greatest athletes on Earth, all jammed together into one person, isn't he? He could do nothing. He had no superpowers. Still, probably the greatest fictional superhero that has existed on Earth since mankind has been doing literature.
When Batman made his debut in a 6-page story called The Case of the Chemical Syndicate, in spring of 1939, what you saw with Batman was what you got. His essential external elements are in that first story. Young socialite Bruce Wayne shares a jaw with his pal, Police Commissioner Gordon, who invites Wayne to a crime scene. 2 pages later, the Batman appears to track down the criminals and solve the crime. In the final 2 panels, a door to Wayne's study opens, revealing the mysterious identity of the Batman. While Superman bounced around the East Coast in his debut, pulling off a half dozen feats in 13 pages, Batman solved one murder mystery, escaped the killer's death trap, and sent him to his doom in 6 pages. Superman had exploits. Batman had adventures. Over the next 6 months in Detective Comics, he gradually added to his bat arsenal of bat paraphernalia, a utility belt, lifted from Doc Savage, a Batarang, a Bat Gyro, lifted from the Shadow, and he carried a gun and knew how to use it. His adventures sent him to a mythical country, where he rescued the damsel in distress by shooting werewolves with silver bullets. All of which was compelling to his young readership. All he was missing was his raison d'être, an origin story. The editors insisted on one, and Bill Finger delivered for Detective Comics number 33. The resonance of Superman's roots was about external factors, where he came from, what he could do, but Finger exploited Batman's internal resonance. In a two-pager called The Batman, Who He Is and How He Came to Be, we see young Bruce Wayne witness the death of his parents during a botched stick-up and vow to use his inheritance to fight crime. The source of his father's wealth would evolve over the years. As Bruce Wayne put it, to avenge their deaths by spending the rest of my life warring on all criminals. Criminals are a superstitious, cowardly lot, so my disguise must be able to strike terror into their hearts. I must be a creature of the night, black, terrible. I shall become a bat. It would become one of the simplest and most fertile origin stories in pop culture. Stan Lee, the cornerstone of the Marvel Comics universe of the 1960s and beyond, and who knows as much about creating heroic fiction as anyone since Homer, put it this way. You try to make an origin as dramatic as possible. Now death has to do with vengeance. Batman's parents were killed and he wanted to avenge their death. If somebody is killed and you feel that should not have happened, that was a terrible thing and I'm going to see that justice is done and make the killer pay, that's a great motivation for a hero. What more do you need to know? He saw his parents killed, said Denny O'Neill, one of Batman's most effective scribes in the 1970s. It was a choice he made. He realizes that he has chosen to do this because it helps deal with the trauma of his parents, but also because it's worth doing, because it's damned interesting. On some level, he enjoys doing it. Certainly Bill Finger enjoyed creating Batman's detective challenges. Everything he did was based on athletics, on using his astute wits and acute observation, Finger said in a 1970s interview. I didn't want Batman to be a Superman. I wanted Batman to be hurt. Batman was given a puzzle to solve or a death trap to escape in every story, and readers got the feeling that warring on all criminals wasn't necessarily the easiest job in the world. With Superman, we won. With Batman, we held our own, wrote Jules Feiffer in 1965's The Great Comic Book Heroes. Individual preferences were based on the ambitions and arrogance of one's fantasies. I suspect the Batman school of having healthier egos. The Caped Crusader's job was made somewhat harder in 1940 when, according to Finger, DC Comics editor Whitney Ellsworth called him on the carpet for having Batman shoot down a giant monster with a machine gun. Batman would never deploy a lethal weapon again, and if his vow against killing made the vengeance game more difficult, it only affirmed his nobility by rejecting the methods that made him Batman in the first place. Batman's driven nature was submerged after the appearance of his brightly colored chum, Robin the Boy Wonder, in Detective Comics number 38, but it reared its cowled head again in an astonishing story from 1948, written by Bill Finger. In the course of solving a smuggling ring, Batman recognizes the mastermind as the man who killed his parents. This is one job I'm doing alone. I don't have to explain. You can understand why, he tells Robin. Calling on the killer, Joe Chill, in an abandoned warehouse, Batman reveals his own identity to Chill in order to prove he knows his foul deed and threatens to hound him until he confesses. In a neat ironic note, Chill seeks help from his fellow criminals by admitting he killed Batman's father, but before he can reveal Batman's identity, he is gunned down by his confederates, who blame Chill as responsible for creating their dread nemesis. By adding a kid sidekick almost a year after Batman's initial appearance, the creative team managed to turn the character in a different, nearly perpendicular direction. A few months into Batman's run, Bob Kane and Bill Finger were joined by Jerry Robinson, a young artist who would wind up contributing pencils, inks, backgrounds, plots, and characters to the Batman storylines. Robinson was on the ground floor in bringing the Boy Wonder into the books. As he described it, Robin expanded the story potential. Batman would save Robin, Robin would save Batman. The younger readers could relate to Robin, and the older readers with Batman. There was a lot of interplay between Batman and Robin with puns and whatnot. It did change the nature of the strip. It became a little lighter. An understatement, to say the least. The Boy Wonder, with his primary colors and relentlessly optimistic nature, took Batman out of the shadows, literally and figuratively. Another crucial contribution by Robinson, arguably more important than the introduction of Robin to the series, counterbalanced the upbeat sensibility of the kid sidekick and reclaimed Batman's stature as a creature of the night, or at least kept one of his bat boots in that territory. By early spring 1940, Batman was popular enough to become the second DC Comics hero to earn his own book. Batman No. 1 was a quarterly book, to be filled with 64 pages of his adventures and new antagonists. Robinson reached to the top shelf of his imagination. I wanted to create a villain that was worthy of Batman. Sherlock Holmes had Professor Moriarty, for instance, and I knew that good characters had some contradiction in terms, so a villain with a sense of humor would be quite different. And once I thought of a villain with a sense of humor, I thought of the Joker. In my family, one of my brothers was a champion bridge player, so there was always a deck of cards around the house. So it was quite natural that I immediately thought of the Joker playing card. Just by luck, that image, a clown, a jester, had a certain edginess to it that most people don't recognize. For example, clowns can be feared by children, and by many adults, too. Bill Finger drafted the first Joker story, and in that initial appearance, the Joker was a serial killer. Although Finger foolishly tried to bump him off after his second appearance, the clown prince of crime quickly became Batman's primary nemesis. His crimes would veer from psychotic to goofy and swing firmly back to psychotic over the years, but his appeal never diminished. Denny O'Neill summed up the attraction of the Joker. The Joker is one of the most interesting characters in all of pop culture, a serial killer who's a clown. Any pulp writer can go with that. We can work with that. He comes into your room, and he may kill you horribly, or he may give you a new car. And you don't know ahead of time, because you can't figure out what's going on in his mind. And maybe he can't figure it out either. While the Joker may have been the first among deranged equals, Batman's famous rogues gallery was the most colorful, inventive, and bizarre that any hero faced during the Golden Age. In that same Batman No. 1, the Caped Crusader crossed paths with the Cat, an early version of the Catwoman, a femme fatale who would continue to bewitch, bother, and bewilder Batman for decades. Bob Kane created the bifurcated menace of Two-Face, and there were also the lighter provocations of the Penguin and a fairly harmless pair called Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Batman also kept up his membership in the Noir Club by duking it out with the fearful Scarecrow and the maniacal Clayface, a horror film actor who sought revenge, clearly after watching The Phantom of the Opera several times too many. Batman never really had the time for the soap opera romance indulged in by Clark Kent and Lois Lane. In the late 1940s, a Lois Lane clone named Vicki Vale was desultorily tossed his way. She was a news photographer instead of being a news reporter. But she didn't have, as it were, legs. Batman's real passion was for chasing down grotesque malefactors and tossing them into the clink. Or, put more simply, he was driven by revenge. No other character in all of comic book history could match Batman's passion for justice. Neil Adams has the last word.
He was just a guy who was on revenge mode. And because he thought he could frighten criminals, he wore a bat costume. He can see it in their eyes that they're afraid. They're cowards. And he can use that and stop them. And he does. And guess what? He's successful. What a fantasy. You know, he actually can do it. You know what happened if you did it or I did it? Bang. One bullet, we'd be gone. But Batman makes it through. And in the end, he's the guy that we want to be. That he is exactly the guy we want to be. The point is that everybody's Batman. Not everybody can't be super. It's stupid to be Superman. Superman's like a god, like talking about Zeus and talking about Hercules and all the rest of it. But Batman, it's possible.
Thanks, old chum. Kid sidekicks. When Batman shared his secret identity with the young orphan Dick Grayson in Detective Comics number 38, moved deeply by his plight, he probably thought he was doing the right thing. Still, the Caped Crusader has a lot to answer for. Dick Grayson grew up in the circus, part of a trapeze act with his parents, the Flying Graysons. A mobster named Boss Zucco was shaking down the circus and arranged for an accident one night, and young Dick's parents were murdered. The Batman took him under his, there's no other word for it, wing. I guess you and I were both victims of a similar trouble, all right. I'll make you my aid. But I warn you, I lead a perilous life. I'm not afraid, responds Dick. And for decades to come, he never would be. After Bill Finger and Bob Kane decided to add a kid sidekick to the Batman serials, they kicked around a lot of names with their associate Jerry Robinson. Mercury, Wildcat, Pepper, Davy, as in Davy Crockett, and Sacco. Robinson recalls, I thought of Batman's new partner as a sort of young Robin Hood, and suggested the name Robin. I had been inspired by N.C. Wyeth's beautiful illustrations for the classic edition of The Adventures of Robin Hood. Once we agreed upon the name, I suggested adapting Robin Hood's costume for the new character. I recall adding the final touch to Bob's sketch of Robin, the small R monogram on his vest. According to artist Jim Steranko, when comic book creators were interested in promoting younger audiences and in unifying their audience with the material, they thought it would be a good idea to use younger characters in the strips. So young Dick Grayson became Robin the Boy Wonder, the sensational character find of 1940, teaming up with the world's greatest detective. It didn't take a detective for the comic book publishers to realize who was subsidizing their new fortunes. Kids. By the early 1940s, statistics revealed that more than 90% of American boys from 7 to 17 and nearly 90% of American girls read some kind of comic book. You also have to understand that when you bought a comic book, you were actually buying 10 comic books or more, said artist Joe Kubert, because each one of your friends bought one comic and we trade them off so that if you had 10 buddies, you had access to at least 10 different comic books. It was an industry built on sticky dimes and lunch money. Cultural historian Bradford Wright suggests that comic book publishers bypassed parents and aimed their products directly at the tastes of children and adolescents. This trend was probably furthered by parental guilt over deprived Depression-era childhoods, that young people deserved greater latitude to pursue their own happiness. Author Gerard Jones adds, previously there had been kids' books, and there had been pulp magazines marketed toward adults, but not until comics was there anything marketed, hey kids, and yet containing the kind of violence and passion and seediness that they love. Whether the addition of a kid sidekick to a grown-up superhero's adventures actually increased sales of a given title is impossible to know. But once Batman made Robin his old chum in crime-fighting, the floodgates were open. Captain America had his comrade-in-arms, Bucky. The Human Torch encouraged Toro to flame alongside him. The Green Arrow mentored young Speedy. The Shield had Dusty to ride shotgun. The Sandman was given the inevitably named Sandy. Mr. Scarlet gained the less intensely colored comrade, Pinky. Sometimes, the sidekick added an exciting nom de guerre to the superhero firm. Witness TNT and Dan the Dynamite. However, the writers clearly ran out of inspiration when they assigned the Black Terror a sidekick named Tim. Jerry Siegel actually created one of the better sidekick variations in 1941. In this case, the teenaged Star-Spangled Kid was the hero, and his sidekick was a rather dim-witted adult named Stripesy. The introduction of the kid sidekick revealed a kind of disconnect between the adult creators of the comics and their adolescent audience. As Jim Steranko puts it, the sidekick was important because it gave characters somebody to talk to relate to, Otherwise, they'd be walking down the street talking to themselves, which is not a good sign in the superhero world. But as Stan Lee, who strenuously avoided co-opting sidekicks in his work if he could help it, explained, "I always felt if I were a superhero, the last thing in the world I would want to do is pal around with some teenage kid. I mean, at the very least, people would talk." Cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer, who was roughly the same age as Robin when he debuted, sums up every 12-year-old's real reaction to the kid's sidekick.
Robin was just along to attract a young audience, which seemed dumb because the young audience was really wanted to be Batman. They didn't want to grow up to be Robin. I thought, keep the kids out of the... I didn't want a boy superhero who was going to make me look bad.
With one mighty word, Fawcett Comics and their happy warrior. There was one kid in comics, however, who posed no threat to any youngster's sense of security, and millions of readers adored him. He was an orphan newsboy named Billy Batson, who was only one word away from becoming the world's mightiest mortal. In the second issue of Wiz Comics, dated February 1940, Billy hawks his newspapers on an abandoned street. A shadowy figure, who actually looks a lot like the shadow, beckons, then disappears into a subway entrance. Billy follows him, only to find himself alone in an abandoned tunnel. Seated on a throne, in front of him, is a wizened bearded man in a simple floor-length robe. He looks like every Jewish kid's vision of Yahweh. Shazam! Billy Batson, I have fought injustice and cruelty all my life, but I am old now. My time is almost up. You shall be my successor. Simply by speaking my name, you can become the strongest and mightiest man in the world. Captain Marvel, speak my name! Billy, Shazam! As Billy speaks the word, he becomes Captain Marvel. In Billy's place stood the mighty hero, a character whose similarities to Superman would prove to be his biggest challenge. Fawcett Publications began in 1919 by publishing Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, a joke book, the one excoriated by Professor Harold Hill in the musical The Music Man, before moving into magazines such as True Confessions and Mechanics Illustrated. When they entered the comic books business, they did so as a lucrative firm. As the 1930s ended, they moved their base of operations from Minnesota to Tony, Greenwich, Connecticut. The story goes that, one day, their circulation director barged into an editorial meeting and ordered up a new superhero for their nascent comic book line. He had to be like Superman, but he had to have the secret identity of an 11 or 12-year-old boy. It was a simple formula, and it worked like magic. Fawcett staff writer Bill Parker developed the idea by proposing a team of six immortal superheroes: Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, and Mercury. When that proved too unwieldy, he gave their cumulative powers to young Billy Batson in the form of Captain Marvel. The fact that this anagram of mythical gods and heroes is rather a mashup didn't seem to bother anyone. Solomon, of distinctly Hebraic ancestry, apparently can gain membership in a restricted Greek club, and Mercury was, in fact, the Roman god of speed. The Greek god of speed is Hermes, but Shazah admittedly doesn't have the same ring to it. Artist C.C. Beck mitigated Captain Marvel's ancient lineage with a more contemporary costume. Beck admitted that the red and gold uniform was based on a combination of a drum major, a chorus boy from a road company operetta, and the outfit of an usher at the Roxy Music Hall. Back in the pulp days, Doc Savage's visage was consciously modeled on Clark Gable's. With Captain Marvel, however, his creators looked to Fred McMurray, a genial leading man and light-hearted contract player for Paramount Pictures. If anything gave away the demographic aspirations of Fawcett in creating Captain Marvel, that was it. Otto Binder, who wrote nearly 1,000 Captain Marvel stories, summed up his approach to the character. "The big red cheese was a sort of kind, bumbling, hulking crusader without armor. using his superpowers sparingly, and subject to the whims and dreams and human fallacies which are all a part of us. Captain Marvel took off immediately, and within a short time he was starring in 3 magazines. The first issue of Captain Marvel Adventures featured a series of tales hastily written and drawn by Jack Kirby and Joe Simon, who admitted that this particular Captain was not their style. "Charming is the word for Captain Marvel," said Simon. "It was enchanting, like a children's story." Indeed, while Captain Marvel's rivals, Superman and Batman, evolved in the 1940s with origin stories and mythologies that deepened and enlarged their characters, Captain Marvel preferred to explode in place. The artwork was genial, the stories were easy to follow, and whimsically unaggressive. Even his arch-nemesis, another balding scientific genius megalomaniac who went by the name of Dr. Savannah, seemed incapable of screwing in a new light bulb without blowing out the fuse box. Jim Steranko contrasts Captain Marvel with Superman. "Superman was very serious about what he did. His job was to kick the ass of any criminal that happened to come within the city limits of Metropolis. There weren't a lot of laughs in the Superman comics, but with Captain Marvel, it was all laughs. And an entire segment of the comic reading public preferred that." And a vast segment it was. By the early 1940s, Captain Marvel monthly sales were surpassing those of Superman, and Fawcett was providing real competition with Detective Comics, adding other successful characters such as Spy Smasher and Captain Midnight. Still, Captain Marvel won the gold watch around the Fawcett offices every time, selling more than 1 million comics a month. In 1944, appearing in a variety of magazines, some of which were bi-monthly, Captain Marvel sold 14 million comic books. It's worth remembering that the most popular comics of the 1940s were funny animal books. Here, too, Captain Marvel hedged his magical bets. During the same month as the attack on Pearl Harbor, Fawcett provided young audiences with an even more sympathetic character than Orphan Billy Batson, a newsboy named Freddie Freeman, who, when injured by the despicable Captain Nazi, is taken by Billy for an audience with the great wizard Shazam. Shazam anoints Freddy with the power of transformation into a mighty young man. All he has to do is speak the name Captain Marvel, and he becomes Captain Marvel Jr., a cadet-sized and more dramatically drawn version of our hero. Soon there was Billy's twin sister, removed from the same orphanage at a young age, who emerged to take on similarly magical powers as Mary Marvel, a thoroughly unnecessary Uncle Dudley Marvel, and Hoppy the Marvel Bunny, who erased any boundaries, if any really remained, between the Fawcett superhero books and their successful funny animal books. The Marvel family, as they were known, was the first real superhero franchise, and far from cannibalizing sales from each other, the characters fed the enthusiasm of loyal readers as they fought together in innumerable escapades. Even Dr. Savannah got his family into the act to fight them, though with predictably ineffectual conclusions. Captain Marvel even pioneered the idea of product identification. When he offered kids the chance to join the Captain Marvel Club, the promotional device proved so popular that Fawcett had to open a new office just to handle the correspondence. At its height, buoyed by the Captain's eventual appeal to patriotism during World War II, the Captain Marvel Club embraced 400,000 members. Of course, membership in the Captain Marvel zeitgeist required even less than a dime. It only required that magic word, Shazam. Magic words, alas, don't have much purchase in a court of law. It was the harsh reality of copyright and commerce that undermined the fantasy world of Captain Marvel. 18 months after Detective Comics vanquished Wonder Man in the courts, their lawyers took on Fawcett, initiating first a cease and desist order, then a lawsuit in 1941, claiming that Captain Marvel had infringed on Superman's copyright. The legal wranglings between Detective Comics, by then known as National Periodicals, and Fawcett went on for 7 years before the case went to court. According to Joe Simon, National's publisher Harry Donenfeld was driven to distraction by Fawcett's superior sales and their comfortable headquarters in Leafy, Connecticut. Both parties ordered up scrapbooks that culled and pasted both Superman's and Captain Marvel's escapades side by side for point of comparison. The case bounced from court to appeals to court again for years, but in 1951, Judge August Hand ruled in favor of National. Both sides agreed to settle out of court. Captain Marvel suspended publication, and Fawcett forked over $400,000 in damages. Apparently, as magic words go, Shazam is trumped only by So Ordered. It's difficult to cast one's mind back over the decades and imagine that Superman really had a rival who outdid him to such an extent that legal action was needed. It's even harder to imagine when one reads the Captain Marvel adventures. They are so benign, optimistic, and trustworthy. Perhaps Captain Marvel didn't pay enough attention to the second A in Shazam. Where Achilles' vulnerability lay in his heel, Captain Marvel's lay in his heart. He was simply too uncomplicated, and the modern age has displayed little sympathy for a heart so pure. Look up in the sky, and in the movie theaters, and on the radio. In the popularity contest between Superman and Captain Marvel, the stakes were high, but as the 1940s progressed, the categories in competition expanded faster than a speeding bullet. Superman had an in-house advantage. His publisher, Detective Comics, was clever enough to create a subsidiary division in 1940 under the Superman Incorporated shingle, which was devoted to promoting the Superman brand in various media. It might be argued that the nationwide hunger for all things Superman outpaced even the voracious imagination of the very company created to exploit him. Nevertheless, the speed and depth of the media penetration of Superman was unprecedented by popular culture standards. Characters such as Mickey Mouse, Popeye, and Flash Gordon had been able to infiltrate kids' consciousnesses and their parents' pocketbooks in a variety of different products, toys, games, promotions. Superman's march to consumer saturation began in January 1939. Siegel and Shuster's initial dream of a Superman daily strip was realized when the McClure Syndicate, which had turned down their spectacular idea a few years earlier, bought the syndication rights to Superman from Detective Comics and asked Siegel and Shuster to produce the strip out of their Cleveland studio. This made Superman the first comic book character to be licensed as a comic strip. It became a phenomenally successful strip, printed in more than 300 daily papers and read by millions, many of whom were adults who had never read a comic book. In fact, for decades, adult commentators would refer to Superman as a comic strip character. In April of 1939, the New York World's Fair opened, celebrating the world of tomorrow. It was only natural that the Man of Tomorrow would make an appearance, and so he did, impersonated by an unbilled actor named Ray Middleton on Superman Day, appropriately marked on July 4th, 1940. There is some dispute as to whether Middleton, who would have been the first actor to impersonate Superman, was in fact the avatar in question. But by 1946, he was facing off with Ethel Merman 8 times a week in Annie Get Your Gun, so Middleton must have had some qualities of invulnerability. November of that same year brought a somewhat bloated but giant-sized Superman balloon to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. The major event of 1940, as regards Superman's expansive empire, was the introduction of a radio show. Radio was, of course, the primary non-printed medium for action and adventure heroes in the 1930s and 40s. The Shadow, the Green Hornet, Little Orphan Annie, the Lone Ranger, and Flash Gordon had all streaked across the airwaves to great success. DC hired a public relations man and producer named Robert Maxwell to create a Superman pilot and to bring it to the radio. And on February 12th, The Adventures of Superman debuted as a 15-minute serial on WOR in New York. It was quickly picked up and usually broadcast several times a week in the late afternoon, just after kids got home from school and right before dinner. Although the idea of a full-color comic book hero without any visuals would seem counterintuitive, the radio program was a huge success, lasting into the 1950s. The already fertile imaginations of kids were inflamed by the hard-working sound artists who reportedly created Superman's flying effect by combining a recording of an artillery shell streaking through the air with a separate recording of a wind tunnel played backward. The effect zoomed over one of the most famous openings in radio history. Faster than an airplane, more powerful than a locomotive, impervious to bullets. Up in the sky, look! It's a giant bird! It's a plane! It's Superman! And now, Superman, a strange visitor from a distant planet, champion of the oppressed, physical marvel extraordinary, who has sworn to devote his existence on Earth to helping those in need. Forced by the conventions of radio to adapt Superman's adventures in an oral medium, the program introduced some innovations. Superman was given a teenaged comrade, a copy boy named Jimmy Olsen, because on the radio he really needed someone to talk to, and to keep the suspense of the serials going. Clark Kent's paper was now the Daily Planet, run by a hard-boiled editor named Perry White. And a radioactive substance from his home planet, Kryptonite, pierced Superman's invulnerable carapace. Even Batman made a guest appearance on the radio show in 1945, the first time these two titans of industry ever met in any medium. As radio historian Jim Harmon put it, "The crossovers where Superman met Batman on the air were equally rare for fictional characters on the radio, where almost nobody but comedians and singers ever visited each other's shows." The stardust didn't rub off on the dynamic duo. Batman and Robin never got their own spin-off. The real heavy lifting was done by radio actor Bud Collier, who voiced both Superman and Clark Kent for more than 2,000 episodes, and initially did so anonymously in order to keep up the mystery of Superman's existence. He was famous for dropping an octave while ostensibly undoing his tie. "This is a job for Superman." If the radio show contributed essential elements to the Superman mythology, his next triumph in the media sweepstakes would allow him to zoom across the silver screen in full color. Paramount Pictures obtained a license to bring Superman to the movies and turned to the renowned animators Max and Dave Fleischer, who had rendered Popeye so entertainingly to the cartoon medium, which was a particular favorite of Joe Shuster's. The Fleischers were reportedly dubious about the practicalities and made Paramount an exorbitant counteroffer. The studio did not refuse and okayed $50,000 for the first 10-minute Superman cartoon, an incomprehensible amount for the time. The Fleischers spared no effort and committed to the assiduous job of putting the Man of Steel and his pals through 17 animated adventures throughout 1943. The installments appeared on movie screens across the nation, whipping up fans, old and new, into a frenzy, while adding new elements to the super saga, including nonstop flying and the new introductory phrase, soon to be appropriated by the radio show, "Superman fights a never-ending battle for truth and justice." Perhaps the Fleischer's greatest achievement, ironically, was to make this primary colored fantasy figure believable. Human characters rarely appeared in animated cartoons at the time, let alone as the full cast of characters, and the Fleischer Superman cartoon set a very high standard for elegant, graceful, thrilling cartoon animation. The Holy Grail was a full-fledged Hollywood film featuring a superhero. But in the era of prestige studios, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Paramount, Warner Brothers, and so on, it was a practical and commercial impossibility. Hollywood was decades away from throwing its weight behind a fantasy blockbuster. As far as MGM's accountants were concerned, the labor-intensive The Wizard of Oz in 1939 was barely worth the effort, and certainly these newfangled comic book heroes were not high-class items. Luckily, there was another way, the Saturday afternoon serials. Serials were two real adventures shown in weekly installments. The average serial adventure was 12 episodes long, running a total of about 4 hours. Typically, the serials were based on Western or detective stories, although Universal had a huge success with its Flash Gordon serials in the late 1930s. Republic Pictures was the most reliable serial machine in the early 1940s, and they set about acquiring the rights to Superman. Either Detective Comics asked for too much editorial control, or Paramount had already sewn up the screen rights for the cartoons, no one is sure, but plans fell apart. Republic Pictures turned to the next best thing superhero